And welcome to the Taylor Report at CIUT, just like the man said, 89.5 FM. Today we're going to be talking to Janice Tidwell, who is a screenwriter and wife, widow of Clancy Siegel. We're going to be talking about Clancy Siegel's last published book, The London Lover. And at the halfway point, we'll be talking probably to Rick Sterling about this curious group called the White Helmets. I think we may be joined now by Janice Tidwell herself. Are you there, Janice?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Hey, it's great to talk to you because we're going to be talking about a great book, a great guy, great fellow, Clancy Siegel. Well, first of all, I think we spoke to you some time ago, and first issue is this book, The London Lover, published by Bloomsbury.
Mm-hmm.
My first concern was it's published in Britain. Is it going to be available here? Or?
In Canada, they said no. But on the other hand, you can look up Amazon for sure. Has it available in the States?
Uh-huh.
That's all I know. And actually, not a reprint, but the paperback edition is coming out early next year or by the spring, I believe.
That'd be great, the paperback.
You heard it here.
Yeah, you heard it here, and the word always immediately in the brain says accessible.
It's a wonderful book to read. It's very punchy. It's very fast-paced. It's anecdotal. It's like a literary nervous breakdown.
In other words, it's autobiographical.
Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about it. He first, Clancy came on the scene, at least for me, that's how I always measure anything, with Going Away. And there's been an association over the years of Going Away with Jack Kerouac's On the Road. And reading this book, I noticed there really is a connection in that when he was writing this when he was writing Going Away, he had a copy of Kerouac that he was, I think, reading. He didn't make it a direct association, but he went out of his way to mention that he was Kerouac was in his pocket, you might say.
I think so, but more than that, he had a huge National Geographic map of the United States, and I believe it was I still have it here in the house. It's a, I think, a historical map, but it's quite large. I have it framed. And he wrote on it as he wrote the book. And so it became his journey, almost like, Ulysses or going across the country, and he saw the movement there. So, yeah, I'm sure he was influenced. I mean, who wouldn't have been writing that kind of book then? But it was very political. It was a political. He was a man living in England, looking back at the United States and his experiences in the land of McCarthy and J. Edgar Hoover and all the repression he experienced after the war in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an expat. He was very much an American patriot in his own way.
Yeah, he had voted for Eisenhower.
He voted for Eisenhower. In fact, I ran across something recently saying if there had been a very kind of moderate Republican running for president against Hillary Clinton or Bush, he would have voted for that person because he was terrified Hillary would get us into war.
Mm-hmm.
But that was at the very end of his life, and we forgive him that.
Yeah. Well, now, you know, I was so... So many writers who talk about him and look at him bring insights about him. I better not try to cite the author, but one of them pointed out, a reviewer, that Clancy was politically promiscuous. And he was kind of all over the map. But one thing he was not over the map about was war.
That's true. And justice.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very much a labor man. He knew the history, the labor history of the United States and probably Europe as well, inside and out. He was very, very well read. And he was always anti-war. He served in the war. He went to volunteer to after Pearl Harbor, but he was too young. And then he entered the war in 1946 before it had ended. He entered the army, excuse me. Mm-hmm. And he had some quite unfortunate experiences, including being a Jew who was pretty much tortured by anti-Semitic campmates down in Texas. Mm-hmm. So he experienced a lot of anti-Semitism and then went off to Europe and then pulled bodies out of the rubble. And as you mm-hmm. know, he went AWOL to the Nuremberg trials with the intent to, the way he told it, was to kill Hermann Göring. Mm-hmm. And
it took a large pistol, which
it was confiscated.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, he said Peter Lorre had said, "Why did you take such a large? You know, you should have taken a." I forget what he said. What are those little guns that women have in their handbags?
Yeah. Derringer.
Little Derringer.
Sort of suggesting that he thought, "Well, you're not serious. If you want to kill him, take a small pistol."
Yeah, coming from Peter Lorre, that was pretty good.
By the way, Clancy had a self-deprecating sort of trick in his mind, and it certainly makes him endearing to as a writer. He will make a strong statement where you say, "You're right, Clancy, we're all in on this. That's the way to go." And then he says, "Yeah, but I might chicken out. I might change my mind." He has a when he was called to testify at HUAC, he said, "Okay, I was there and I was solid, but I did have the names in my pocket in case I had changed my mind."
Mm-hmm.
Now, he could have left that out, right, and just gone ahead and be a hero in the sense of making it turning it into an iconic sort of bit of conduct. But instead, he reminds you that he was very human and he was not sure he was going to stand up.
Well, there were very few people who did stand up, and it was a time of contradictions where everyone was betraying everyone else, including themselves. Mm-hmm. And he wrote in the book Black Sunset that he had that list in his pocket, and I think about that from time to time because I'm working on something having to do with that. And I'm literally, if he had a list in his pocket, I'd be surprised, because mm-hmm. he wasn't stupid. if he was ever pulled over, and uh-huh. frisked, and they found a note in his pocket, he was savvy enough to know. So whether or not he actually literally had a note with names in his pocket, I doubt it. But
I'm really glad you mentioned that. It crossed my mind
Well, he was that kind of a writer, and in both of these books, or Black Sunset, which we talked about before, sort of the prequel to The London Lover, and he wrote those books as at the end of his life, mm-hmm. looking back on those times, and he had a lot of clarity. But I ran across a Xerox copy of his 1950s journal. Mm-hmm. Reading everything he was writing about wanting to be a writer when he was an agent, mm-hmm. and when the FBI was at his door, and when he was going up and delivering scripts to George Cukor, or later when he's writing in England about even the days over here. It's just so fascinating because he really was there. That's the incredible thing about Clancy. You can have a little bit of skepticism about some of the anecdotes, but truly he was there, and he was never on the shelf. He was always down and there in the trenches until he couldn't be at the end of his life. He had a lot of physical problems, mm-hmm. but mentally he was. I mean, he was with the young people of Occupy. How many years ago?
He went to the South. He went to Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. He got involved in a lot of wacky things. If you read the London Lover, mm-hmm. it's really quite incredible that he had that journey from having tailor-made suits on Savile Road to being up in the pits and the coal mining pits, coal pits.
How many writers go down into the mine itself? How many? Not he's one of a handful.
And he did. And he came to the UK full of revolutionary anger that he had, that was contained when he was in Hollywood during those kind of crazy 1950s years when he was up on the Hollywood Sunset Boulevard and the Sunset Strip during the time of McCarthy.
Yeah. How he got pulled all these moments and causes into Clancy is really, it makes it a terrific read. By the way, we're speaking to Janice Tidwell. She's a screenwriter and, of course, is wife of Clancy Siegel. And I once talked to you about this. I picked him up again when he had a cover of Nation magazine, and the title of his essay was The Karma Ran Over My Dog. And it turned out you're the karma.
Well, I suppose I was.
He decided to write across the Atlantic and live with you.
We were an unlikely couple, particularly when you read his amorous history in both of those two books. It's wacky.
I have to ask you, did his amorous history bother you at all?
Oh, no. Yeah. No, I knew most of it. And I knew the legend of Doris Lessing even before. I never was able to read The Golden Notebook when it was popular. So when I met him and I heard that he was the character that she based a character on him, Sol Green, the sexy, brash American, it was intriguing. But, all I could do was open up those pages and kind of glance at them and yawn. it wasn't that interesting to me.
What a remarkable... there's another wife. There was Margaret Walters.
Margaret Walters.
Who was a major feminist thinker, advocate, organizer. And how in the world did the world's champion male chauvinist end up with these two women?
Well, he loved strong women. He was drawn to strong women. He did not have relationships with women who weren't, for the most part. And his mother was incredibly strong. She was a labor union organizer, you know that. And she was pretty much fearless, and she had her secrets, and she was tough. I ran across letters the other day that she had written to Clancy. He was asking her about her early days as a union organizer, and she witnessed the Triangle Fire in New York City. I believe that was Greenwich Village, up on the ninth floor, or wherever it was. And she saw the body. She was not there. She was an organizer for unions at a very young age, and she met Clarence Darrow, and she met.
My guys.
Eleanor Roosevelt came up to her after she spoke. After the Triangle Fire, the rich women, progressive women of New York, very, very wealthy women, one of them who had a big estate up on the Hudson, invited this big labor group to come and spend a few days for a symposium. And all these rich people were talking about having soup kitchens for the workers. And Jenny Persily was about 18 or 19 years old, and she got up and she said, well, that's the wrong approach. We want jobs. We don't want soup. And she spoke for about a half an hour. You couldn't hear a pin drop. And that was, and Eleanor Roosevelt came up to her and said, I'm so glad you said what you said. So Clancy came from that. I never met Jenny. She died in the 1950s, but she was a magnificent woman who was hauled off to jail, took Clancy down to Chattanooga, Tennessee, while she organized, and she had a very tough time, very poor, and had a young son, a young illegitimate son, because she was never married to Clancy's father, Leo Siegel.
He had a family in New York, I guess.
He did.
A second family.
Yeah, Clancy never knew about it until he was an adult.
Somewhere Clancy wrote that his father thought he had married a taken up with a redheaded bohemian, but when Clancy was born, she turned into a Jewish mom. And his father was thought the world had changed. He was very anxious about his dad. I remember interviewing him once, and he was at great pains to try to determine what his father thought of his book going away. He couldn't tell whether the father liked it or not, but it really meant a lot to him.
I think ultimately his father was very proud of him.
Of course. I tried to tell him that, but by the way, he wouldn't take it as a...
No, he was a tough... The father, Leo, must have been a very tough guy. I mean, just very, very tough. And but he wasn't around very much during the Depression, and he was off doing his thing and then probably secretly going back to visit his family in New York.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's Janice Titwell, a screenwriter, and of course... Now, I forget how the credits go. Clancy Siegel's name is on Frida, which won an award. And
oh, well, we wrote screenplays together for many, many years.
So how is, I mean, that, by the way, I think I told you once that on another occasion that I went to UCLA to hear Clancy and other panelists talk about, I guess, Hollywood and war or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was introduced, they said he's the author of Going Away, and a Weekend in Dinlock, and the audience was polite and listened to that. But then they said, and he's the script writer for Frida, and then they all applauded, which must have startled
him. I assume they forget. Yes.
They really ought to know.
he didn't like screenwriting. He didn't consider himself a screenwriter, really. He loved books, and he wanted to be a writer. In fact, that was the reason he left Hollywood when he was an agent. He felt like an imposter because he harbored ambitions to be a writer while he was representing big-time screenwriters in Hollywood, blacklisted screenwriters, people who had credits, people who didn't, people who were writing under the table. Nelson Algren, he represented, and who came out to work with Preminger on The Man with the Golden Arm. So he made it. He went to London. He became a writer, and his relationship with Doris Lessing was so complicated. They fed off of each other, they entrapped each other, and they used each other to help fuel their writing.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened for many, many years. They continued to write to each other well up into the last part of her life until she was so furious with him after he wrote a piece about their affair that was published, I think, in the New Yorker or New York Times. And when he asked her to do a blurb for his book about his mother, she was incensed. And I still have the letter it is a bit of a
please. I hope someone, I hope some smart publisher, editor, and yourself get together and give us those letters. What an amazing collection that would be.
Well, a lot of
and
them
mom's
are already...
letters. You know, yeah, I never got. I always listened for her voice when I read Clancy, and he loved her so much, and it took so much from her. But I kept thinking, let mom say something. I wanted to know what she was thinking.
Oh well, I wish I had time to read you a short one because they are really amazing, very, very smart. Even though Russian was her first language, and.
Mm-hmm.
She had broken English, but the letters come through clear as day about her history and what she was up to.
Yes,
so getting back to Clancy, he loved strong women. He was inspired by
women. Why would Margaret Walters, with her, she worried about her, some of her friends were very unhappy with her, that she took up with Clancy, right?
Well, I don't know. I never met Margaret, and I'm reluctant to say anything about that because I only know Clancy's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
She was a feminist. He met her at a feminist meeting. And why? Why do people go to banks to rob banks? Because the money's there. Well, a feminist meeting has women there. So that's why he ended up at feminist meetings.
Yeah.
He was very smart, you know.
Yes.
But he was inspired by the strong women that he saw in the movies, and a lot of the English women. And he loved Wendy Hiller.
Mm-hmm.
I Know Where I'm Going. He loved Vivian Leigh, Valerie Hobson. So when he went to England and met, ultimately, very soon thereafter, met Doris Lessing, she was very familiar to him. And he thought, you know, this makes a lot of sense. I know her. And he knew her from the movies. He didn't really know her, but he was comfortable in that way. Yeah. And I suppose she was comfortable with him in the way he was like a Hollywood macho guy.
He did, for the British, he seemed to be the classic Yank, right? The one they'd all heard about, the tough guy and the wisecracks. And he said he livened up. Obviously, he got on the BBC on those talk programs, the literary talk shows. And, of course, they loved it because he was very smart, witty, and challenging. Let me ask you about the writer side of him. Some little things that are curious. He had, when he was writing, going away, he said that Bruce was doing the writing. Who is Bruce?
Oh, he had, the way I can explain that is that he felt that there was someone else who did the writing, and that was a kind of detachment. He felt that he was an imposter. He didn't actually do the writing.
Wow.
And he found himself in the set of highly in the literary world of London. They were all very progressive. And he did have his credentials because he was a refugee from McCarthy. So he had those, but he hadn't really established himself as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
So he felt that I would say that he felt that he was an imposter and he put himself over on the side. But he also was someone who went to England. If you read the book very carefully, I was not joking about the nervous breakdown. He really had a huge nervous breakdown, or a series of nervous breakdowns. This was a man who had a therapist, a psychotherapist in his life for almost 50 years.
Amazing.
He needed that kind of stability. He identified with Styron, William Styron, about his depression.
Mm-hmm.
And I found papers and quotes and things about depression because he knew an awful lot about it. He wanted to write a book about depression. And also the fact that he got involved with the psychiatrist R.D. Lang and the work they did with schizophrenics, it was no accident. It puzzles me, actually, why he was with in Lang's set for those few years when they were all taking acid, LSD, straight from the Sandoz lab.
How he survived it,
How he survived it, how he kept working and writing, and did everything else he did.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was that there was some kind of higher plane with mental illness, that schizophrenics, how could you, he had very complicated, I can't even begin to explain them all, really, how he felt about schizophrenia and about anxiety and depression, because he suffered with a lot of it.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. He's very candid about, of course, at a famous moment, or it's certainly famous now, he was on a stage with Iris Murdoch and fainted into her lap at an anti-war meeting, I think. But this was something with throughout his life, right? Did that continue in the years that he returned to California?
Yes. When I first knew Clancy, I got a call from him at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, the biggest hospital here and next to Beverly Hills. And he was hospitalized. He was brought in. The paramedics brought him in. He was visiting his friend Francis Ring, who had been F. Scott Fitzgerald's secretary.
Oh, my God.
Wonderful Francis Ring.
What does Clancy miss?
Well, he met Francis when he was teaching at USC, and she had been about 18 years old when she was F. Scott Fitzgerald's secretary. She wrote a wonderful little memoir that was made into a film called Against the Current with Jeremy Irons playing F. Scott Fitzgerald. Wow. Must have been about 20 years ago. Mm. But anyway, Frances was, he was visiting Frances. He collapsed. She called the paramedics. They took him to the hospital. And that happened all the time. And I always thought he was having a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And well, I called the paramedics. You know, it
yeah. Well, you said he had a heart attack in 1984? From eating a hot dog?
He had clogged arteries. It was before I knew him.
Oh.
1984. I had briefly met him. But I didn't know him, and soon after I met him, he was living with people here in L.A. as he was teaching at USC, the University of Southern California, half the year, and he went to the Dodger game, had a Dodger dog, which is a hot dog, mm-hmm. and came back and suffered a heart attack. Luckily, they got him to the hospital. He spent a month in the hospital. Yeah. But that was long before he and I got together.
Yeah. I want to ask you quickly about your thought. Did you know him as a writer when you met him? Or did you think about him as a writer? What was your assessment of him?
Of course I thought of him as a writer. He was amazing. He was one of the smartest. I mean, I think he's probably the smartest person I ever knew. Yeah. It's just so complex and so deep to yeah. think about how that was, but he was someone I could talk to. And he could talk to me. Mm-hmm. And when you find someone like that, you don't let them go. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't read his books. I didn't run out and buy any going away. I had never read it.
You just knew he was very smart.
I just knew he was smart, he was funny, he loved movies, he loved jazz, these things that I loved. And so we ended up going to the movies together. He loved Joe Turner, I loved Joe Turner. It was fun. We had, fun with people. I had been around people who had been blacklisted in Hollywood, but I was much younger. I was of a younger generation. Mm-hmm. But he lived it. And mm-hmm. I found that fascinating. I loved his stories. I heard about Haldeman and Ehrlichman at UCLA, how he was the editor of the Daily Bruin and all of his antics there. But also, it was just the way he thought about politics. And I suppose I'm a very political person in my heart and soul. And we could talk. Mm-hmm. He was a brilliant writer. Sometimes when he wrote, it just blew me away how fast he could write came in his mind.
John Lahr used the word acrylic style, and somehow that really seems to work in my mind. He's every sentence is alive. You can't open a Clancy Siegel anywhere without something really going on that you want to keep reading.
And he was a journalist. He took the details.
Crazy details.
And in his two memoirs he wrote at the end of his life, Black Sunset and The London Lover, he did a lot of research when he needed to look back and remember what those things were, and he used them. What he wasn't great about was emotion, and that was just something that just destroyed him. He didn't know how to get to emotion. But I think I have to say, in The London Lover, there's one episode that broke my heart that I knew very little about, and that was his falling in love with a young girl who was upper class, who was really part of the landed gentry, and she died tragically. Mm-hmm. And he was very, very upset and mourned her. Mm-hmm. He had told me early on that she was one of the women he had actually loved. Mm-hmm. And there was a very short list.
Yeah.
And Doris wasn't on that list.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I have to tell you, yes, it's powerful, like a punch in the chest, because he gives a voice to his kind of semi-fascist friend, the that really disturbed man who who berated him when the girl died. And that is very hard.
Hardiman.
Very hard to read that. I want to say about, in this last letter part of this, is thanks to you, you chose a strong woman, obviously, The London Lover and Black Sunset are two books that you obviously had a hand in making them happen because he wasn't in the best shape. And I got to ask you about something in relation to that. He was dictating at some point because he was going blind. Now, that must have really been an ordeal.
That was at the very, very, very end of his life. And he knew he couldn't write a book at that point. He loved E.M. Forster, and he had known E.M. Forster and interviewed him. And he went back to read, when he was blind, he was listening to the books. But at that point, it was also very much, he was on hospice, and it was the end of his life. So there was not much to write down at that point. There were a few of his blogs that he would publish and send out to his friends, but they were less coherent at the very end. Mm-hmm. But it was so moving, as I wrote in the foreword to The London Lover. He said he wanted to die, but he wanted to write, and he was fine with the contradiction. I had a little bit of a trouble with understanding what he meant, mm-hmm. but there's no contradiction. I want to write, but I want to die because I can't take this anymore.
Well, he must have been grateful. We are that you worked him through those books because they are two of the most readable, important books. Black Sunset is
a sensational
book.
That's lovely to hear. He wrote, when he was writing The London Lover, I have this in one of his notes, which I'll probably end up giving to his archives down at the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas. Mm-hmm. But he wrote about, he said something like, this couldn't be, getting back to what you said before, this couldn't be me. It had to be him. I was tormented, blocked, and in pain. But his hands flew over the keys. I waited for my aches and pains to dissolve, but they got worse, a life of their own. He felt that at the end of his life when he was writing and trying to put together The London Lover. But he felt that from the 1950s on, from the after the war. He was Mr. Pizzazz, you know, he was so charming and sexy and good-looking and energetic and, you know, on the town as an agent and making deals and all of that. But his secret life of anxiety and depression and, wanting to carry on, but sometimes it was very difficult for him.
But he did it, and you did
it. He did it.
You guys were a great team.
He taught me so much and so much about writing and about life, and I'm very, very grateful I had my 30 years with Clancy Siegel.
Your 30-year weekend in California. Janice Tidwell, it's such a pleasure to talk to you, and, of course, it's always a kick to talk about Clancy Siegel. And The London Lover is a great book. I can't wait for the paperback. And we would look forward to maybe we could talk again because there ought to be some more books here, the letters, et cetera.
Well, I'll look into those letters of Jenny Persily and see what I can send you.
Oh, I'm really thrilled.
And I love talking about Clancy. It keeps him alive. I have his Corona typewriter on my desk here in the house that he had in the 50s on. And so he's still close by.
Close with you. Well, thank you, Janice Tidwell.
Thank you, Phil.
Okey-doke.
My pleasure. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Janice Tidwell. She is a screenwriter, and she was the wife of Clancy Siegel. They worked together, and, of course, it was her energy, I believe, that led to the publication of the writing and publication, The London Lover. And if you ever want to know about the British left and British culture, and from right to left, by the way, there was a moment I didn't get to there's so much to talk about, but he wrote an essay called Conversations with a Fascist Beast, where he went and hung out with right-wing Brits on the street. And it's a scary essay. People should in these times should read that as well. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT. It's 89.5 FM. We're going to have some music, and we're going to talk to Rick Sterling after a while.